Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the Beer Ladies podcast with your hosts, Lisa, Katie, Christina, and myself, Tandy. You can find us at our website or all over social media. Our website is beerladiespodcast.com, and our social media, Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, Blue Sky, TikTok, and even Facebook are at Beer Ladies Pod or Beer Ladies Podcast. If you'd like to support the show, you can find our merch store link on any of our social media bios or in the show notes for this episode. And if you'd like to sponsor an episode, do mail us at beerladiespodcast@gmail.com. Now back to the beer.
Hello and welcome back to the Beer Ladies podcast. I am Lisa and I am your host today, although I am joined by co-host Christina. Hello, Christina. And she's saying hello. She's saying hello. She's waving. But we are very excited because we are doing another one of our beer history interviews. And this one really crosses styles and history. We're very excited about this. But we are thrilled to welcome Lars Marius Garshol. Hopefully I said it pretty well. So hello, Lars.
It was pretty well. Absolutely. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. So thank you so much for joining us. And before we dive into today's topic, we want to do our sort of usual going around the horn and find out what people are drinking. And I know I'll start with you, Christina, because I know you're not on the sauce tonight, but.
No, I'm sorry. You're all going to have to bear with me. I have a bit of a cough, but I once again have my skull mug with my lovely berries tea. Yay.
We all love this skull mug. It's been on our socials. People have seen it. It's almost got its own fan club. So it's good to see it again. Wonderful. And Lars, how about yourself? What have you brought for us today?
Yeah, I'm drinking farmhouse ale.
Oh, gosh. And is that out of a wooden cup as well?
Wooden bowl, yeah.
A wooden bowl. Oh.
It's not... this one is not really traditional. It's too small and it's not painted. I only thought of that now. I have a real one in the next room.
Oh, wow. Oh, well, we can definitely put up some photos later if you've got some. So we'll yep. Definitely dive into that a bit more. Oh,
so this
that's
is
wonderful.
The beer. It's Kornøl is the style. It's a raw ale with crack.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
Juniper, of course. Yeah,
and juniper, of course, yes, and it's got a beautiful can there too. We'll try to put some pictures up. It's a red can with some lovely gold lettering on it. So we will come back to that. And for myself, we don't really have a lot of Norwegian farmhouse ales here in Ireland. I know that's going to shock people. So I do have a Ballykilcavan Clancy's Cans number 12. It's their IPA. So obviously nothing at all related style wise, but it is made there on the farm at Ballykilcavan. So I've done my best to get a little tie in there. So, and this is a lovely beer. I've had it quite a few times before. It's part of their sort of one-off series. And yeah, this one's a very nice IPA, 5.5%. And it's been a lovely one. So excited about that. So that's our usual formalities out of the way. So again, welcome Lars. And I wonder if you could give us a quick introduction and then we'll talk a little bit about maybe what you've been doing with beer history. But before we get into that, we think we want to know about you and we want to know about Norwegian farmhouse ales, because I know there's a lot that can be said there, but we'll start with you. So tell us about yourself and how you got into beer history.
Okay, so I started as somebody who was just interested in beer, like tasting different beers, trying them out. I used Wraith beer before Untapped was a thing.
Right.
Really explored the globe, all of the styles. And then I came across Norwegian farmhouse ale, which nobody really knew about. Like people who were knowledgeable had some idea that there was something there, but nobody really knew what it was. And I got super interested in trying to understand what it was, because it tasted so completely alien.
Right.
It didn't taste like modern beer at all. And it was really digging into that where I started seeing that, okay, so people are making it in this county, and this other county on the opposite side of the country, they're also making it, but it's completely different.
Mm.
And then you have to try and work, okay, well, what is it? Where does it come from? And that sort of led me to understand that it was farmhouse ale, and that basically people made it all over the country originally, like literally everywhere.
Right.
I'm on the edge of Oslo. The local history museum here, which is really just a volunteer thing, they have a farmhouse brewing vessel from 1840 standing there. So like anywhere you see a farm, they will have brewed. But so how did I become or get into history? So when I got interested in this, the starting point was the brewing that was happening now. Because that was something that you could travel to see, you could understand what they were doing, you could taste the beer. But it was really trying to understand how does that fit into the larger beer world that forced me to go backwards.
Right.
Because you see people doing things that don't make any sense. They're completely different from what everyone else is doing. So you have to try and go backwards to try and see where does it branch off from the brewing that we know. And then I discovered that actually learning about, you know, brewing in Mesopotamia or whatever you like actually helped me understand it.
Oh, that's interesting.
But Brewers Publications published this book.
Oh,
Historical Wonderful. Brewing Techniques.
I have a copy.
The Lost Art of Farmhouse Brewing. But the point of the book is that it's not lost and it's not historical. It's here right now.
So it's a bit of a misnomer. Lots of myths to bust.
Two misnomers in one title. So that's pretty good.
I don't know, Christina, I think you're not at that level yet with your book coming out soon. But I know the struggle is always real to land on a title that everyone's happy with. So
yeah. Long story.
Yeah, it always is. And to dive in a little bit more to those different styles, and like you say, kind of everyone was making them, but it looks like there were a couple different, maybe sort of broad categories, talking about the historical ones first. But what is that that sort of mapping, if you like, still hold true? Or I think, are these categories sort of malleable, if you like?
Well, they were very malleable because, you know, everyone brewed the way that they learned from their parents, maybe with a couple of modifications. And so on, you know, back into prehistory, effectively. Right. So there was absolutely no standardization of any kind. But today, the brewing has been through sort of evolutionary bottlenecks where they were down to very few brewers, right?
Right.
So it's, I wouldn't say it's standardized, but we have like three fairly clear styles.
Okay.
That are recognizable. And in the Western Norway and in Central Norway, and then in the East, there's people who brew stuff that's outside of those categories, but they are so few that it's, you know, if you have a single brewer, you can't really talk about the style.
Right. It's just what they make up that particular farm or.
Yeah, pretty much. So yeah, that's kind of the state of things.
Oh gosh, that's interesting. And Christina, I don't know if you have a question to bring in here, but I think it's so interesting that, like you say, this is, you know, these are kind of the historical things, but they haven't gone away. They're still around. So I wonder if you could maybe speak to that a little bit. Or I don't know if, Christina, if you want to delve into a bit.
Yeah, I was just going to ask sort of how, we introduced the book. If you could talk a little bit about how the book came about a little bit more.
Oh, great shout, yeah.
For our audience, if they're not familiar with the book, what it's about. I mean, we've kind of touched on that, but just a little bit more. Just a little bit more
on the book first. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, so the book is kind of my attempt to explain to people who know brewing, really know how to brew, what is farmhouse ale? What is it like? How is it made? What does it taste like? What are the different ways of making it? And why was it made the way that it was? Because if you don't know the background, a lot of the stuff that you read in here is going to be, haha, that's ridiculous. Nobody would ever do that.
Right.
But if you get the context, then it makes a lot more sense, and it comes alive in a different way. So the book also tries to, it explains about these. It goes into, you know, what were the occasions that they brewed for, who was doing the brewing in on the farm. So it tries to go into more of the background as well and try and set the scene a little bit. The way that it came about was, well, you know, I did all this research. I had to tell somebody. I started planning this book, and then Stan Hieronymus put me in touch with Christy Switzer, the editor at Brewers Publications. And when I sent her the kind of outline and beginning text that I had, she was like, nobody's ever heard of this stuff before. We're taking your book.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that no one knows about it is a good thing, because I know sometimes it can be a bad thing depending on the publisher, but that's wonderful to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that struck her, as I recall, was I had a photo that I got from the Estonian National Museum of somebody who was not just brewing stone beer. They were sprinkling rye flour onto the stones before putting them in the mash.
Oh, interesting.
I've seen videos of that on YouTube, and the rye flour catches fire. It looks like you're pouring gasoline on the thing.
Yeah, we'll have to try to put some links in the show notes, because I remember seeing that as well. And I feel like there was a trend in, well, trend maybe overstating it, but I feel like there was a moment maybe in kind of the mid to late 2000s where people, at least in North America, I don't know if it was the same in Europe, were sort of discovering, and I'm putting that in air quotes, things like Sati and things that are sort of related, although maybe not quite the same. And I feel like there was a lot to do with throwing stones into hot water and seeing where that led. And I wonder how much of that is sort of meaningful, like in the case you described, versus kind of maybe a bit of showmanship. I don't know.
Stone brewing definitely was a farmhouse brewing technique. It was used in, or I have evidence of it from pretty much all of the countries that I've studied.
That's great.
And you know, the Steinbier, the commercial style that was famous, that was also definitely a farmhouse ale. When you see the equipment, the ingredients, the malting equipment, it's like it's straight out of my book almost. they were even using juniper in Steinbier.
Okay, we'll definitely come back to the juniper, because I think there's a lot of different directions to go with that, but. Yeah, but before we do that, I don't know, Christina, do you have any more book follow-up questions? Because you are allowed to have as many as you like. So,
So that's your first book, and I think that's really interesting. But you recently wrote another book. If you want to talk a bit about that as well.
Yeah, this one's encrypted. It's in Norwegian, so you can't read it. But it's my attempt to sort of give a portrait of Norwegian farmhouse ale at, you know, on an academic level, really going into it. So like this map with the dots, different names for the beer in different places. We have, let's see, that's a bad one. How did people exchange yeast in the Voss area?
Wow.
Each box is a person.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, different methods for keeping the yeast, blah, blah, blah. All everything in detail is really what I'm trying to do. And then also trying to work out more of the history, why things are the way that they are and that sort of thing. But also, can you see Norwegian regions that are similar to each other?
Mm.
And of course, different from each other. And
yeah,
the really obvious conclusion was that Western and Eastern Norway were like two different countries.
Oh, that's fascinating. Just a completely different approach.
But if you see a map of Norway that has terrain on it.
Right.
There's like a huge chain of mountains running all the way from the south tip of Norway up to central Norway. And it can, mm-hmm. Many places it's 100, 200 kilometers wide.
Mm, yeah.
And nobody lives up there because you can't.
Right, exactly. Yeah, nature doesn't want you to, so.
No, basically,
yeah.
And Lars, how far back, for our listeners, how far back does your research go? Like, what sort of historical periods do you cover?
Well, my main focus is the period from which I can get detailed descriptions of the brewery. Mm-hmm. And that, in practice, that ends up being late 18th century up until, today.
Mm-hmm.
But I've tried to go as far back as I can. But of course, once you go further back than late 18th century, then you're on to guesswork.
Right.
And, little bits of archaeology, right?
Yeah.
So, no, that makes sense.
I feel that there is evidence that you can find there that helps you understand why things are the way that they are today, why there are regional differences and all of these things. So, but I'm using that more as the background and not as the focus, I guess I should say.
Yeah. No, because I know that there's evidence for hot rock brewing that dates back to like the Viking Age. So I know, archaeologically speaking, so I know that that's a very long-standing technique. So it's really interesting to see that you're sort of tracing it from the 18th century on, and that this is still something that's
there's a continuity.
Yeah.
Actually, this thing with the stone evidence is interesting because there is a particular type of heat-shattered stone that you find in the soil in Norway. Find it in huge thick layers on every farm, and there is actually documentary evidence where somebody asked a farmer 150 years ago, "What is that?" And he says, "Oh, that's brewing stones. It's from when they didn't have metal kettles and they had to use stones, but they only go back to the 7th century." As far as we know, at that point, we should have had 4,600 years of brewing. So
right.
So where's the evidence? But it turns out there's another type of stones that go even further back, but they don't go far enough. So we have 3,000 years of probable brewing where we really don't know what was going on.
Yeah, and you probably have some, 19th or even early 20th century archaeological reports where people are taking notes but didn't know what they were looking at. So it may be buried somewhere in an old site report. So.
Could be. We actually have descriptions of people doing stone brewing in Norway. All of them from a pretty small region in the country, which is quite interesting. But that was published by people who had no real knowledge of beer brewing and also none of archaeology.
Right.
So that is reports that really the significance of those reports really only was appreciated quite recently.
Yeah. And we've talked about before on the podcast how we need to get Maren Dinley on, because when you have someone who understands both the brewing and the archaeology and can look at those things and say, we recognize what's going on. I think it, like you say, it absolutely can unlock a lot of things that maybe would be obvious if just the right person looked at it. So
yes.
No, you're grand. I was just going to say, before we get too far in advance, can you describe to everyone exactly what stone brewing would look like, or a version of it, just so people understand if they're not familiar?
Yeah, that's a very good clarification. Mm-hmm. So the starting point for this is that metal used to be historically extremely expensive, to the point that not too long ago, anything made of metal was considered to be semi-magical.
Right.
So the reason that a lot of farm doors have these big metal bands is that's magical protection. That's what it's really for. And that's also why people would hang horseshoes over the door. It's nothing to do with good luck. It's to ward off evil. But again, it's because metal is considered magical. And this meant that they didn't have kettles. The price of a kettle was just completely astronomical.
Sure.
Back in the Middle Ages. So then you have to brew without the kettle, and your brewing vessels are of wood. Do you now place them over the fire? Maybe not.
Right. They won't last very long.
But you have to heat the mash. If you don't heat the mash, there isn't going to be any beer. So what do you do? Well, you take a wooden vessel, fill it with cold water and malt, and you dump hot stones in it, and you heat it up that way. That's stone brewing, basically.
Yeah. And again, I feel like there was this mini trend. Again, trend is the wrong word, very briefly, where people got very excited about it. But again, I felt like it was at such a remove, if you like, and it was maybe inspired by one or two outliers, if you like, versus kind of this longer standing tradition you're speaking about. So,
well, I think a lot of that was inspired by Michael Jackson's report on Steinbeer.
Which has
confused people no end, because he visited this brewery in Franconia.
Right.
Where there's absolutely no evidence that there ever was stone brewing, although of course there must have been.
Right.
And they were brewing with hot stones, and they had heard interview tapes with a commercial stone beer brewer brewing the style of Steinbier. And they were showing that they were dumping the stones in the wort to boil it, which is not what I just described, right?
Right, right.
Somebody who has no kettle, like, why would they boil? There's no point.
How did that happen?
It's just a waste of effort. And what about the real problem, making the mash? So, but what happened was Steinbier came from Austria, a region called Carinthia, bordering Italy. And they really did hear tapes of a real brewery from a brewery that closed in 1917 in the town of Klagenfurt, but they ignored everything that the tape said. They just did their own thing. Of course, Michael Jackson didn't know this. How could he?
Right.
He just showed what they were doing. But I think a lot of people have gone with the stones go in the wort, because that's what Michael Jackson showed on TV.
Right. Oh gosh. Yeah. So just slightly lost in translation. Briefly.
Well, I mean, it's he reported everything that he saw accurately. It's just these guys decided they wanted to do it a different way, which, you know, you want to invent your own Franconian Steinbier tradition. That's fine,
right?
Yes, not really a problem. Yeah. It's only when people go, this is what stone beer was like historically. That's like, no, that's not right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we tried something, or, you know, they tried something here in Ireland with the Filicfia beer and the Moore Group, which is an absolutely fascinating study. And we will link that in the show notes for everyone that wants to read about it. But they did an amazing, you know, experimental brew, trying to use stones here from, you know, a technique that they believe might have existed in Iron Age or older.
Right.
So yeah, we'll link that so you can all, but it is slightly controversial, for sure. So we'll link that in the show notes. But yes, stone brewing is absolutely something that's popped up here in our in Irish native brewing practices as well. Not without controversy though.
Yeah, but like you say, there probably was something of the sort going on in that period for the same reasons. I mean, you know, metal is very expensive, you know, all of these things. So
there was brewing before the Bronze Age. I don't think they had kettles.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they weren't, you know, hauling around. Exactly. They just didn't have those kettles. But yeah.
Yeah. And I think you brought up something really interesting, Lars, when you introduced the beer that you're drinking. You said it's a raw ale. And can you explain to people what a raw ale is and how this sort of links in with what we're talking about right now?
Yeah, that's a really good one, because a raw ale is just a beer where the wort hasn't been boiled. It's not the style. It's kind of like sour is not the style, because there's many different kinds of sour, right? But raw ale is really, really common in farmhouse ale. I think of the people who are still brewing farmhouse ale today, I would say that more than half don't boil the wort.
Oh, interesting.
It wasn't that unusual in commercial brewing either, if you go further back. Like Berliner Weisse was originally not boiled. And probably more styles if you go further back. But as Christina is hinting at, the connection here is a lot of these farmhouse brewers, when they get a kettle, they go, oh, nice, much easier to mash now. But they don't start boiling.
Right.
They never boiled. And just because they get a kettle, they don't start doing
it. Yeah, why start now? Yeah, it's more fuel.
Yeah, and also it changes actually the flavor of your beer quite substantially.
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
So it is actually quite a big transition, and you know, it takes time. Yeah. And in fact, one of the challenges for farmhouse brewer is to cool the wort. You usually have 150 liters. It's in a big wooden vessel. Cooling it down is really, really slow business.
Right.
And if you skip the boil, you start from, say, 65 degrees instead of 100.
Right. Sure.
So the time savings are much larger than they might seem. And of course, when they're boiling, they're doing it by feeding this fire with firewood. It's not like you just turn on the electricity and you wait.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I was just thinking about that because I know we have up at Canvas Brewery, we have one brewery in Ireland where it is that, you know, fire, like literal wood-fired kettle. And again, it's a proper kettle, but like you say, that takes a long time to get up to the, you know, the temperatures you would need. So, or I guess maybe need is the wrong word, are used to. But I guess if you have a different technique, you don't have to spend that, well, not just that time, but the expense of the wood.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's an economic impact as well.
Yeah,
definitely.
But I think mostly it's a question of, for them, I think it was mostly that the impulse to boil didn't reach them.
Mm-hmm.
But this region where this style of brewing comes from is kind of, there's like a barrier of mountains around the whole area.
Oh, that's
so they were slow to take up other things as well. For example, when they made cheese, they didn't boil the milk either.
Oh, wow. So there's a whole sort of tradition of just a lot of different things. They just didn't do it. That's interesting. Oh, wow. Yes.
But I suppose if you don't need to, why would you? You know, like it's something that I know Martin Cornell has talked about in the UK, and it's something I've found in Ireland as well. Like, why would you spend the money on the fuel? Or like you're saying, you know, having to cool it down. It just, without the inclusion of something like hops, where you need in particular to get to that, you need that boil.
Yes.
Why would you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another good point because... that's one of the things that makes this not taste like a modern beer, that the IBU is so incredibly low. The, you know, a normal beer has like a backbone of hop bitterness that's kind of almost the flavor is built around. And in these beers, it's just missing. They don't have it. Or if they have bitterness, it's usually from the juniper. So it's a different bitterness flavor. And so that's another, you know, hops are a new introduction into beer. And in a lot of farmhouse ales, it hasn't really broken through completely. For them, it's almost like it's something that they're adding to prevent infection. They don't really care about the flavor of it.
That's interesting. So I know you've mentioned the juniper a couple of times, and I think we need to, you know, let's talk about juniper. So I know it comes in a couple different places potentially. So I guess maybe... what does it look like? And are we just talking about sort of stirring with, you know, sort of juniper? Or like you say, you've got a sort of actual bowl for drinking that's potentially juniper. What is that? How does juniper fit in? Because it's clearly an element throughout. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a long story. Let's start with what it is. it's a conifer tree that usually just grows as a low bush. But if it gets the right conditions, it can shoot up and be 20 meters tall. It's actually, of all the trees in the world, this is the species that has the widest distribution of any. It's super adaptable. It grows all the way south to Croatia in Europe, all the way across Siberia, and even across North America. There are two ways that it's used. So one way is that when you filter the wort out of the mash, you put juniper branches in the bottom.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And since they spend a long time in hot liquid this way, because the lautering takes a long time,
right?
When you do it this way, so you get quite a lot of flavor that way. But particularly in Norway, they don't think that is enough, so they don't brew with water. They brew with juniper infusion. So you put juniper branches in the kettle and water, you heat it up, and you make it can be like a pale green tea, or it can be dark brown, depending on how you treat it. Mm-hmm. So this adds, you know, this adds bitterness, and you get woody, resinous kinds of flavors. Really, you know, people like to say it's like pine, and yeah, it's a little bit like pine, but it tastes like juniper is what it tastes like. you just have to get to know the flavor. But
right.
What I think a lot of people have missed out on is the fact that of all the spices that have been used in beer, this has to count as number two historically. So
fascinating.
There is evidence of juniper use going back to 800 before Christ in Denmark.
It's great.
There would be a lot more evidence if it weren't for the fact that a lot of the analyses of dried up beer from archaeology are done by looking at pollen grains, and juniper pollen is not stable.
Oh, interesting.
So if it was there, you wouldn't find it.
Right. Ooh.
So the ones that they found was when they did chemical analysis, and they found substances that are peculiar to juniper, and they're like, oh, okay, it must be juniper. But it has been used, or it has been common to use it in the beer in, let's see, Norway, Sweden, Finland, the three Baltic countries, in Russia, also in the Steinbier in Austria. It has been used in Germany, but it wasn't common. It has also been used in Denmark, but it wasn't common. So actually, the places where there's evidence for farmhouse brewing in some detail and you don't find juniper are two countries where there isn't a lot of juniper. That's Denmark and the UK.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah, so it's just, it's almost purely, it's not there, so they don't use it. So.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. Yeah,
because I can remember, again, when the big sort of salty craze happened in North America, it was very like, they just threw a lot of juniper in everything. And maybe sometimes that worked and sometimes it was a little unbalanced. But I feel like they almost sort of just kind of cribbed some notes, but maybe didn't go all the way into what one of these might look like. They just kind of were we want that flavor. Yeah.
I think at that time it would have been difficult because juniper is a bit of a tricky ingredient. It matters what the plant looks like, and it matters which part of it you use, and then it matters how you treat it.
Mm.
So like a classic mistake that I made was just cut some juniper, fairly thick branches, throw them in, boil them, and your beer tastes of cleaning fluid. It's like borderline drinkable at all. And the mistake was thick branches and too much heat.
Mm.
So we I was on Gotland to see the Swedish Gotlandsdrikke just last fall, and with me was a very experienced Sahti brewer and an American brewer, Matt Becker, who is he's brewed a lot of Scandinavian farmhouse ales because he's interested in it. And we see this Swedish brewer take these juniper branches and throw them in and boil them, and we're all three of us are like, "Hey, are you quite what?" And then we're talking like, "What is this? Oh, this doesn't make sense, right?" And the beer has to be ruined. And I go, "Well, why don't we just taste the infusion? And it's fine. There's no problem."
Oh,
I'm like,
wow.
"Yeah, but then how? We still don't
Right.
know." Yeah.
That's
So
funny.
what I'm getting at is, if you're using hops in your beer, you know how to do it, right? This ingredient is also tricky, and a lot of us don't know how to use it.
Right. Yeah. And I know, Christina, you recently made a historic beer by doing some sort of, if you like, teas, infusions to sort of see where that would go. So something along those lines.
Yeah, we did. We brewed. I did a collaboration brew with Closet Brewing Project, or their Closet Brewing just now, in Edinburgh for my book launch, based off of a recipe from 16th century, I think, off the top of my head. And we did different sort of teas just to taste the infusions because we weren't familiar. We used yarrow and bog myrtle and some other things, and we opted not to use the bog myrtle in the final product. But we did that because we tasted the teas and figured out how to scale up and that kind of thing. Because again, like yarrow has quite a strong sort of stagey flavor, and it can take over. So we kind of did a somewhat similar thing with, although I don't think they're quite as perhaps finicky as juniper might be. But it was an
Those two,
interesting
by the
process.
way, yeah. Those two, by the way, are also farmhouse brewing herbs. They show up in the evidence, especially bog myrtle.
That's kind of why we use them,
Yeah.
well, for the historical reasons. And then there were some, oh, Meadowsweet was another one
Yes,
that we
yes.
looked at, because there was a burial in North Mains in Scotland from the Bronze Age that had a malt. It looked like malt or grain-based, possibly alcohol product that had Meadowsweet in it. But yeah, so that's interesting that it's also in farmhouse ales. So
Yeah,
yeah, maybe.
meadow sweet is a living tradition.
Yeah.
It's not historical, it's still going on.
Right. Yeah, it's still happening.
There is one brewer in Voss who learned to use it from his father-in-law. But his father-in-law said that you can't actually use it in the beer. What he does is he takes the flowers and he rubs the inside of the fermenter with it, and then he
Oh,
throws them away.
interesting.
And that's enough to flavor the beer. And his father-in-law used to say that if you use more than that, your beer will taste of soap. And that sounds
Do not
even
want,
more fierce
yeah.
in the local dialect.
Oh, I bet. Oh, I love that. So actually, this talk of ingredients too once me makes me want to sort of get onto to the yeast, because I know there's a this is very, very particular, if you like you're not just, well, I'm sure sometimes you are, but I guess you're not just sort of going to white labs and getting whatever. But and again, I know some people are trying to sort of take yeasts that'll kind of go in this direction, if you like, but tell us about how the yeasts tend to work in kind of in this space.
Yeah, so here in Norway, to take one example, you couldn't really buy yeast until the 1870s.
Right.
That's when they started importing factory-made yeast. It was possible, if you lived in a town, to go to some sort of brewery and get yeast, but for most people, this was impossible. You
Right.
had to maintain your own, because and the reason you had to is, if you're making sourdough, you can just get the yeast from flour, right? Because it doesn't matter what yeast you use, really. It just has to make CO2. But for beer, you have to have really particular yeast to get a good result. So basically you had to maintain it yourself, and everybody did.
Right.
So that's in fact what is on the can. It's a yeast strain. So, a device that was used for keeping yeast between brews. And
oh, that's amazing. Okay.
I shouldn't mislead you now. These were quite rare.
okay.
A much simpler version would be, just a wooden log, mm-hmm. or even a ring of straw, or in fact, the most common in Norway was pieces of cloth. You just dip them in the yeast, it sinks into it, and you hang them up to dry. So the reason this works is when you add yeast to the beer, it multiplies. You get more yeast than you added. So a brewer always has a surplus of yeast. You always have more than you can use. Mm-hmm. So you can keep going forever. You just take it from the previous beer, put it into the next, and that's it, right? And of course, sometimes it goes wrong. And that's right. When you go to your neighbor and you get good yeast from them. But it sounds really simple, and it is very simple, but it turns out you have to do it exactly right. If you treat the yeast like a normal, like a modern brewer does, it's going to go sour within a couple of brews for the most part. The other thing about this is that the way the people were treating these yeasts, and now I'm talking about farmhouse brewing from, Orkney Islands to the Ural Mountains, northern Norway down to, who knows, somewhere in Germany at least. They were all treating them in ways that are different from how modern yeast was used. So fermentation was much hotter at body temperature, which is, insane for a modern brewer. Very, very fast fermentations. Like you would harvest the yeast like the day after or 2 days after. And the fact that not always, but a lot of the time they would dry the yeast. And most modern beer yeast can't be dried. It dies.
Right.
So
makes sense.
Yeah. Huh. So it really looks like all of these brewers and, farmhouse brewers in Suffolk or Orkney Islands or Wales, Denmark, Poland, wherever you like, it looks like all of them use the type of yeast that's different from modern yeast or types of yeast. I mean, it could be many types. Who knows?
Wow, so there's a big project out there for someone who was a yeast sort of chemist to go and do that work potentially. So
we're doing that work. So
oh great,
awesome.
Yeah, my next meeting with the microbiologists is Friday morning.
Oh wonderful. Okay, we love to hear it.
That's really exciting.
Yes. So there is some very good work coming with. It's their research, so I can't really say what they found until they published it. But the yeast that was used in this, which is called Kveik, is yeast that people have been reusing in Western Norway for many centuries. They still have it. And when you test it genetically, it's like, yes, it's clearly different from modern beer yeast. And it has exactly the properties that when if you look at archive documentation of how they were using it, turns out, yes, it can be dried. Yes, it likes hot temperatures. And yes, it's super fast at fermenting.
So I guess maybe the obvious question is when we see like a modern modern craft beer from essentially anywhere where they're using what they're calling a Kveik yeast, are mm-hmm. they the same? Or I guess where... I guess, is there a flavor profile that maybe they're insinuating, if you like, when we see that? Or is this something almost completely different that they're using?
No, they are actually using real Kveik yeast. So when I started collecting these yeasts, I was a little bit desperate because the brewing didn't seem like it was very healthy. And if they didn't keep brewing, the yeast was going to die.
Right.
So I thought, I have to get people to use this. So I sent it to commercial yeast labs where I could basically to get them to commercialize it so that it would be and it's really become quite popular. I mean it's being produced over much of the world, and it's if you go on to Untappd and you type Kveik, there's like 4,000 hits.
Yeah, and I guess that's why I'm slightly almost like dubious is the wrong word. I'm like, but is it the same, or are they just kind of hopping on a bandwagon?
There are differences. So if you go to a farmhouse brewer and you get dried chips, in there will be a large number of different strains.
Sure. Oh, okay.
And the number that you find depends a little bit on, you know, which brewer you go to, but also how good your methods for finding strains are.
Right.
So some labs will say, yeah, there's two strains in here. And then Carlsberg will look at the same thing and they'll say, well, we found 45.
Right.
This isn't really something that you can, you know, count with any. It's like counting different colors. Are these two colors the same or different? Well, depends, right? Yeah. But when you buy commercial yeast, you get one strain.
Right.
They're using the full set, and you can not with all of these, but with some of them, you can definitely taste the difference. And you can also see differences in behavior. Quite a few yeast strains have the property that if you use them alone, when the beer is finished fermenting, they don't clump up and drop out. They need other strains that are different from themselves to do this. And I'm sure there's similar things happening during fermentation as well, but we just don't know about it because nobody studied it.
Right.
So there are differences, but when they say they're using Quake, it's true. They are.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. And I had no idea there are so many different varieties, but I guess there are so many different types of every yeast these days, I suppose. So,
well, that's if you look at, you know, how many different modern commercial beer yeasts there are, there's not a huge number of lager yeast. There's a very small number.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yeah.
And the commercial yeast, I think the big Galone et al. Study in 2016 had something like 100-150 commercial yeast strains. But the Belgians who looked at Quake analyzed, I think, 28 cultures, and they have 280 different strains.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah, and they still haven't looked at all the cultures, right?
So sure.
Yeah. And I wanted to say that there was a Norwegian brewery that took Quake from one brewer. They worked with somebody who broke it into strains. And then they skipped the ones that there were the most of. And they picked three of the rare ones. And they brewed the same beer with those three different strains. And they were really different from each other. No difficulty telling them apart.
That's so cool.
Super interesting project. It's a real shame that they just made it once and now it's gone.
Oh yeah, no, that would be so interesting to repeat and maybe do it under different conditions and
yes,
see what
absolutely.
You got. But
fascinating. That is so cool.
Yeah. And Christina, you may want to jump in on this one as well. But so back to kind of the wooden bowl and so on, I'm thinking kind of the material culture, if you like, around this kind of brewing. Because there's obviously both the brewing and kind of the serving of it, if you like. So I have many questions, and I'm sure Christina does as well. So
yeah, that is an absolutely gigantic subject if you want to go into the culture around it, because it touches almost every side of peasant culture.
Yeah, well, even just something like you said, this yeast strainer, which might not be very common, but just the fact that something like that exists is fascinating and, you know, says something about that. So, yeah.
Let me show you some pictures. This is a farmhouse drinking vessel.
Oh, wow. Christina, do you want to describe that to the folks at home? That's amazing. You're like lost for words.
No, she's muted.
Sorry, I'm on mute because I'm on mute because my dog is barking. It's a bird. Is it a duck?
Looks like a duck.
And
yeah,
and it's really colorful. It's yellow and green and red feathers. And like the bowl part is like the back of the duck with its little tail feathers. It's so cute.
That's amazing.
It's very cool.
This is a book of it's all different.
Oh, the chicken.
Wow.
The chicken one.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
So there's, you know, you get the idea.
Wow.
And this is one type of Norwegian beer bowl, and I could show you like 10 more books.
Wow. I feel like there's a purchase in my future. I feel like, you know, my not very good Danish is good enough to at least read that Norwegian, maybe. So yeah,
probably. Yeah. When you read it, Danish and Norwegian is almost the same.
We'll get there. Cause I guess it's just like beer horn, if you like, more or less, or beer vessel, more or less, if you translate it into English. But wow, those are amazing. And I think, you know, again, for anyone who like me, you know, went and did a lot of archaeology grad school and saw a lot of sort of libation chambers and drinking vessels, like, okay, those are mm-hmm. fine. Like, your Greek ones are fine. Those are cool, though. Like, that's that's like next level stuff. It's so colorful. And but I love the animal shapes. That's so interesting. And so many birds. That's
this book is called Beer Hens.
That's it's Beer Hens. Oh, wow. So that's a very specific.
If I get a different book, you get you get the ones that have horse head handles.
Oh my gosh! Okay, it's like I'm here for
and
that.
Yeah, we can carry on. Yeah.
Wow. Typologies. Yeah.
Are there modern artisans? Are there people who make these now? Like, say, if I was like, I want to buy one of these. Are there people making them now?
Yeah, it's kind. If you want to buy, typically it's easier to find an antique one. Mm. So the people who make them now mostly make them for themselves.
Okay.
Yeah. The last time I was in Voss, they served us their own homebrew, you know, in Schenge, and one of the guys he'd made the one that he was serving us in. Actually, he'd made three different ones, and there is a it's called Cultural Academy of Western Norway. They actually do courses in carving these like every 2 or 3 years.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, wow. Okay, Christina is making this amazing face, people at home.
Sign me up. I'm going. 3 years from now, that's where I will be if that's when they're having it. I'm going. That is so cool.
Oh, my gosh. So, yeah, we clearly need to do a deep dive on those separately. But just tell us about your wooden bowl, and because, again, it's just beautiful and...
You mean this one?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. The one you're using now. And I know you said you have an even more sort of historic one, but
I have this one is made commercially for the same brewery that made the beer.
Oh, okay,
and
very good.
The reason they did that is this is what you're meant to drink the beer from. It's made to be drunk from these.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, if you think of wine ceremony when you're serving the wine, right? It's a really important part of driving home the point that this is not just liquid, right? It's not water we're drinking. And if you want people to, you know, sit up and take notice of your beer, make them drink it from this.
Oh, here, here. Yeah. Yeah. Folks, get your drinking bowls. We're here
for
it.
But the one I have in the other room, according to my dad, it was probably painted by my grandma.
Oh, wow.
So cool. It was probably made in a workshop in the town where he grew up, and she probably then bought it without paint, but because she was into the it's a particular style of decoration that's called rosemaling, rose paint. It's really twisted floral shapes that sort of tie into each other, and this is painted in that style, which was very common. You could do typologies of these shapes that they draw. And then there's poems around the rims of the bowls. And so that's
a whole
genre of its own. So, I mean, I have a whole library of books just on bowls.
So cool.
Oh my gosh, here for it. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing. Those are really cool.
That's amazing. And again, I feel like we could dive into that and talk about just that for hours. But I know we're coming up on time. Because we want to make sure you can get to bed and everyone else as well. But are there any big myths you feel like we should be busting about Norwegian farmhouse ales? What's the one thing people think they know that's just wrong?
Well, we did a few on the way. And I think actually the thing I would like to draw attention to and that I tried to do in this book is, you know, this photo is from Russia. There's farmhouse brewing going on in Russia, in Belarus. It's not just Norway, right? The Baltics, mm-hmm. Finland. There's people still brewing in Denmark and other places that you would be surprised to hear that.
So like you said, it's a living tradition. It's not something that's, you know,
it's not historical, or, you know, This beer is historical in the same way as porter is historical.
That's a great way
historical
of saying it.
Porter comes from the 18th century. Who knows when this comes from, but you know, they're equally historical as far as I'm concerned. I really dislike that the BJCP put the farmhouse styles under historical.
Yeah, well, I think we all have various issues with how these things get sort of categorized and shaped.
But it's also also the focus on Norway. I mean, I am Norwegian. I tend to talk about the Norwegian beers the most because it's closest to me and I know the most about them.
Yeah.
But the other ones are equally interesting. You know, go to Lithuania, go to Estonia. Don't go to Russia.
Maybe not right now, Yeah, I'll have to see if I can find some when we go to Denmark and Sweden for Eurovision. I'm sorry, we have to mention it every episode because, you know, it's our fault. But, you know, so we'll see what we can seek out.
You won't find any in Denmark, unfortunately, unless you do a 1.5 hour drive out of Copenhagen, you won't get any.
Yeah, no, even going to Odense a lot, it was all just your typical, you know, Carlsberg and friends out there,
it's the brewing in I'm actually right now trying to find brewers to visit in March, and first person I look up when I Google his name, I find the person responsible for his estate, so he's dead.
I got
his phone number 5 years ago, and Googling a little further, I found the death notice. He died in January this year.
Oh no, so sad.
And then through another person, I got hold of two ladies who know brewing. They're 90 and 94 years old.
Oh my goodness, wow.
Yeah, so, and then we found one guy who is not old, so we're gonna visit him as well.
Oh, well, best of luck in that. So I don't know, Christina, any closing questions before we...
Yes.
Go for it.
Not question, but I do want to mention that Lars and myself and actually Moss from the brewery in Tipperary.
From Canvas, name, yes.
There we go. Sorry, Moss. We're on the Bjor podcast a couple years ago, wasn't it, Lars? Talking about Lithuanian farmhouse brewing. You were talking about it. I was asking questions. It was on the Bjor Fest podcast. And I was asking questions and you all were experts. And it was yourself and Simonas.
I couldn't recognize what you were saying, but yes.
Yes.
The Irish one.
It was the Bjor Fest. So we'll link that in the show notes, friends, as well, because if you want to learn about farmhouse brewing in a different place in Lithuania, which Lars is also an expert in, I do highly recommend that podcast. It was fascinating. I knew very little about Lithuanian farmhouse brewing, so I was just happy to be there and ask questions and just learned so much from everyone and fell in love with the brewing and everything I learned. Absolutely, we'll link that. Highly recommended. And they had Simonas from the Dundalus brewery on, which was absolutely just incredible. So we will link that as well. You all can learn a bit about Lithuanian brewing as well.
Oh, so fantastic. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Lars. I think with that, I'm going to end on, I have learned that there are ale hens and that's a thing that exists in the world. And I need to find out more about them, but I think we've only scratched the surface. We could clearly dive into each of these things, you know, on a much deeper level. So we might have to do a part two sometime, but for now, Lars, thank you so much. Christina, thank you as always. And folks at home, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Thank you.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.